Well, if you have a chance to get to your website here of coasttocoastam.com, take a look at the pictures that we've got. We're going to talk with George Haas and John Lavasser about something on Mars, geoglyphs, just amazing. But you've got to look at them if you have a moment. So get to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back to Coast. It's been about a year, but let's get back to J.P. Lavasser. J.P.'s a member of the Society for Planetary Research, a veteran instructor of math and science at the Northern Maine Community College. He has begun his research of Mars way back into the mid-1990s. He has published the Journal of Scientific Exploration back in 2002 with Dr. Horace Crater, and in the Journal of Space Exploration in December with co-authors George Haas, William Saunders, and, of course, Dr. Crater as well. So let me say hi first to John. JP, how are you?
Hi, how you doing?
Good to have you back. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, I talked your ear off last time.
That's all right. You're going to talk my ear off again. But it's good stuff. George Haas, of course, love the guy, member of the Society for Planetary SETI Research, founder and premier investigator of the Cydonia Institute. He is a member of the Pre-Columbian Society, and that's a part of the University of Pennsylvania. And he is also an author. Became interested in the face of Mars after reading a book by a Rodolfo Rafael Pozos back in 1991. How's my Spanish, George? Not bad, huh?
That's pretty good, George.
It's good to have you with us, too. It's been about a year since you've been on with me. Let's start with you, George. What have you been doing?
Well, since JP and I were on last,
April.
In April last year. We've been trying to get this science paper published, and that's really consumed most of our time. The last time we were here, we had submitted the paper to the Space Technology and Applications International Forum in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was accepted, and Dr. Crater presented it at the conference. So that was the beginning of this, and I think that's what we spoke about last time we were here.
And George, when this paper that you've been trying to get published, I mean, you're running into some resistance?
Well, it's actually most of the hard work was putting it together, but it's gone pretty smoothly. Dr. Brandenburg recommended that we submit the paper to the conference in Albuquerque, and it was accepted. And after that, we snapped into action and submitted it to the Journal of Space Exploration, which was also a recommendation by Dr. Brandenburg. And JP can tell you about that because he was basically the lead author of the paper, and he did all of
this. All right, let's go to you on this, JP. Tell us a little bit about this.
About how what it is to publish a paper like that.
Not easy, is it?
Yeah, on something so controversial. It went fairly smoothly, but I'll tell you, there's a lot to getting a paper published in a peer-reviewed journal. I must say Dr. Musha and Dr. Mehta of Mehta Publications that publish this Journal of Space Exploration, it's a different JSE than Journal of Scientific Exploration, it was a pleasure to deal with a scientist of that caliber. I was kind of surprised to see it accepted, and for him to report back with such positive comments. It's a published paper, as controversial as it is. Difficult. You have to have the format right. You go through the processes. The one mistake I made was at the end they have what's called a galley proof, where you have the last minute changes, you know, that you make that would be their typographical errors, not any content. And I failed to get that all in on time. But otherwise, everything went smoothly. It's published. People can read it. We've actually have a technical paper published in a peer-reviewed journal on this very controversial, very specific feature that is all part of the Mars artifacts argument.
And it is amazing. Now, we've got at our highlights reel at coasttocoastam.com some of these geoglyphs that George and JP provided to us. Make sure you get a chance to take a look at them. If you don't have a computer now, do it tomorrow morning. They are strange, George, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And JP was actually the one that discovered this this formation back in, I guess, 2000, 2001. And it caught the attention early on of Dr. Van Franelen, who I'm sure you remember in early 2001, he did a press conference in Washington, D.C., showing a whole set of, you know, he was presenting evidence of, you know, these artificial structures, mostly pictographic formations that he had found through other people's research and his own research. And this was one of the highlights that was presented at that conference, or that press conference, which, you know, just all, this is a, there's a long history connected to this so-called Nefertiti face or the profile face that, you know, like the face on Mars. There's a lot of history. There's a lot of story behind it. And we're just very excited that we actually got this paper together and finally published.
And
celebrate.
And you should. And JP, for people who aren't by a computer, would you kind of paint us a picture of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it's controversial. When you look at features, I mean, you have to understand, I always make presentations on this subject. And people are very interested in it. They don't necessarily agree. I've learned the hard way that you have to explain from scratch what's going on because it's very difficult for people to understand
what
this is.
And then explain it again.
Well, what it is archaeologists on Earth will use satellite imagery and aerial photographs to look for promising digs and to also develop you know, existing ones better. Like Sarah Parkak, for example, is a well-known archaeologist that's known to use this technology. When we look at the Mars images that have been returned by our space probes there, we're doing that same sort of thing. You're looking down at the surface of Mars, and all of a sudden, people starting back with the early researchers, Vince DiPietro and all the others, say, hey, we're seeing things that look artificial. And it's very subjective. It's very difficult to take images and say, hey, this looks artificial. On Earth, when these archaeologists do this, they take their images and they make an argument to people who are going to foot the bill, right? And to go and make these at least preliminary digs to see if there's something. Well, this is on Mars. The very idea is difficult for people to accept that there could be artifacts, structures, and things up there that we're seeing in the images. But, you know, a pyramid is one thing. But geoglyphs or large-scale art is another. You're seeing a face. And, you know, you've heard the expression, you can see the face of Jesus in a tortilla chip.
Oh, yeah.
I think I've seen something on the Internet where they actually had something like that, where it actually looked pretty good.
Or on a piece of toast or something.
Yeah,
like
you know,
that.
You and I joked last time about seeing faces in the nap of the carpet.
That's right.
But, you know, so this is what's going on. And it's a very difficult thing to get in people's heads so that they understand that we're doing a sort of a, well, archaeology has to do with humankind. I don't know. We don't even have language to describe what we're doing. We say geography when it's really nothing to do with Earth. So, yes, what's happening is that we're studying the Mars images, and what we see, and I'm sorry I'm going on.
No, that's okay.
What we see in the image, in these images, is that in this particular case, we see what appears to be something that was made on the surface in a sort of artistic sense. It could be something more complicated going on, but yes, it looks like a face in profile, approximately 2.5 kilometers across, large now. Remember, the image resolution is not very good.
Unlike the face at Cydonia, which was part of a structure, like it was carved out, this looks more like it was etched or painted in, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah, the face on Mars, the famous face on Mars, appears to be a very large mesa that was originally natural, but kind of, you know, developed.
Like Mount Rushmore.
Right. And but facing upward, right?
Right.
And this, you're right, this one is made of depressions and elevations, mounds and such that have been, we think, possibly excavated. There is some reason to believe certain areas don't look like they could have been made naturally. So yeah, we were looking at pits and mounds and things that have been dug out with not too many great changes in elevations, dark and light areas. If people say they're shadows, we have a great piece on that. The people are still talking shadows, really haven't read our paper. We went to great extent in the paper to show that those are not shadows. It's not a mesa. It's not a mountain. It looks like an excavated area.
Yeah.
Not very deep.
And to me, what really strikes a pose here with this thing, it's not the face alone, but when you add in this Egyptian-looking hat that it's wearing, then the whole structure looks like it was made, doesn't it?
That's the thing. When you look at these kind of things, it's so subjective. It has to have some. It has to come together as something to you looks like it had to have been made. And there's so many parts to this thing. George notes many, many. He's an artist now. He can point out many things that come together and say, this probably has to have been artificial. And when you're mentioning the cultural references that most people immediately acknowledge, there's a reason why it has been commonly referred to as Nefertiti face, right? We don't think it really is Nefertiti, but it sure does remind us of those Egyptian crowns and Egyptian art where they show the whole eye, even though it is in profile. That's a very detailed eye. If that was a realistic head, that person's eye would be on the side of their head like a deer's, you know? It's a problem if you want it to be realistic picture of a face. When you look at somebody's face in profile, you don't see the nasal point. But here's their whole eye, and that's one of the main reasons it reminds us of Egypt, the eye of Horus, you know, and the way they drew people's faces. Sometimes in Egyptian art, you'll see they got two left hands and things, and it kind of reminds us of that. And so you're right, you know, it has an Egyptian look to it. All this, of course, is just what it reminds us. We don't really know what it is, I'm glad to hear you say that, because most people acknowledge that it does remind them of something Egyptian.
It sure does. Now, if it is indeed some kind of artwork, etching, whatever it may be, but that it was made, what do you think the message is that they tried to convey to people? Obviously, you see it from above, so they wanted somebody from above to see it, didn't they? How about you?
We have the same tradition. This is George speaking now for the audience. We have this tradition here on Earth. Ancient cultures produced these large pictographic formations. We have the pictographs down in the Nazca Lines, down in Peru, American Indians all throughout the Midwest and in Wisconsin and Ohio. We have the great mounds that the Indians built, and some of them were linear type of formations that you could only see from above. They were all over the United States. They recently found one over in Russia of a big deer or an elk, which was just recently found. So this is like a human tradition to create these large pictographic images that we can see from above. And looking at this profile face on Mars, you could say, well, it's like seeing images in clouds or something in the wood grain. And in nature, it's true. You can find formations that look like a face. It may have a forehead and a nose shape and a lip and a chin and maybe an ear. Might even have a dark impression that looks like an eye. But that's about as far as you may get, like 4 or 5 points of anatomical features. But we're looking at this face on Mars that goes way beyond that. We not only have a nose, we have a nostril, we have a mouth, we have lips, we have the forehead, we have an eye, we have an eyelash, we have the iris. I mean, there's this secondary features that we're seeing in this, which goes way beyond, you know, something you'd see in nature by chance, which I said would basically be maybe 4 or 5 points. So this goes well beyond that.
Well, it sure does. Now, this was obviously done prior to, let's assume the Martians are us. They came here and duplicated many things that we still see on Mars. Was this an escape mission to come to this country, this planet, or was it, something exploratory? What do you think it was? Start with you, JP.
Oh, that's the fun stuff. To speculate about how that is, where it came from. My mind reels into all kinds of what we call origins scenarios, right? And none of those are acceptable to people. Tom Van Flandern told me himself, a world-class astronomer here, he said that nobody is in a position to know what can and can't be found on that place. And he included himself in that group. But the problem is we start talking like that, none of these things really, I'll tell you right now. Hey, Mr. Nouri, I see you on TV once in a while.
I pop up once in a while.
And there's this television series that I enjoy. I watch it once in a while. And I think you do a nice job commenting on things. And I don't know if I can mention the show
Ancient Aliens?
Yeah, the Ancient Aliens show.
Sure.
The Ancient Astronauts Theory. This is something I'm pushing 60 now. I've been reading about this since Von Däniken's book back in the 60s, and I found out that this theory even precedes him. To Von Däniken's credit, he's known for, he never claimed to be a great scientist, but boy, he asked the crucial questions at the right time, and inspired a lot of us. I've been studying this ancient aliens, ancient astronauts theory for many years, and I'm to a point now where I'm not ashamed to say it's probably true.
Yeah.
And anybody who disagrees is, needs to go back and do a little homework. It's a strong theory. And, we've yet to test it. It's a perfectly testable scientific theory. And there's much more work to be done. Most of the researchers, of which you are very familiar, Philip Coppens, Andrew Collins, mm-hmm. all of them, Childress, and they, all of them might not be totally correct in their findings and conclusions, but I think as a whole, the theory stands very strong. Of course, Mars and the artifacts we see there is tied into all that, along with the UFO phenomenon. So if you're familiar with the ancient astronauts theory, and this starts to come into the picture, well, how does this tie in? Well, if we have indeed extraterrestrials that have come to our planet in a very distant past and have had their hand in humankind, maybe even made us, like many religious texts.
The Sitchin theory, as I call it.
Pardon me?
The Zachariah Sitchin theory.
Well, Zachariah Sitchin. I have all his stuff here. I have a row of paperbacks here that takes up the whole shelf, his 12th planet series. How would Mars come into play? Well, of course, if you've got extraterrestrials coming into the solar system, wouldn't you expect to see them leaving their mark on our moon and the other planets? In fact, we've got junk on the moon ourselves.
That's right. Hey, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more about your work. I want to know if NASA's interested in what you have written. We shall be back. And welcome back. JP Lavasser with us. George Haas will take calls with both of them next hour. So, John, let's get back to your work, and George as well. So this paper that you've been working on, has NASA reacted to it? Have they seen it? JP, let's start with you.
Well, no, they don't treat this subject very well. It's the great image. Let me tell you, those are great scientists that get results.
Yes.
They have these very complicated missions and there's tens of thousands of images we have to study. They even had a wonderful image request, a very user-friendly site where enthusiasts like me could actually image certain areas. It was great. I'm fifth grader can do it. Sounds like I've imaged a lot of, I've managed to get quite a few images you feel like you're actually pointing and shooting the Mars Global Surveyor mock cameras yourself when you do this. And it sounds like a like a pretty technical accomplishment, but their user-friendly site, I'm telling you, an average person can do this. They're absolutely wonderful. But they, of course, don't treat our work very seriously or give it any attention at all. There's a considerable amount of ridicule at times. You know how they'll post images like the Gale crater that looks like the happy face there and all these Valentine hearts and stuff. And I don't know why they waste all their energy posting these little things like that. I think it's a dig at our kind of work. But yeah, I haven't heard anything from any of them about this paper or any of our stuff. I don't know. I get a feeling sometimes there are people there who take it seriously, but don't publicly come out and say anything.
Okay, now with the paper, I assume you had conclusions. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we made a lot of conclusions. First of all, there's things about shadows. We can say for certain that the dark areas are not shadows, that they are darkened lower elevations, that the higher elevations are the lighter colored ones. We showed that there appears, this is how I found the whole thing in the first place. I was studying fluid being ejected from a fault north of that face. It appears to flow downhill to the south, which is opposite most of the planet, into this ravine, and then into this area, darkening the low areas. And it appears like there's a fluid there, which is controversial enough on Mars. But to throw this in, yeah, we've had a number of conclusions about, what you see. What is it that we're actually seeing? You're not looking at clouds. You're not looking at a Rorschach int block chart. These are real features on the surface that the elevations from the Mars orbital laser altimeter, we went to great lengths to show that what you're seeing is real there, and that there's probably fluid and there's low-lying areas.
What about vegetation in the dark areas?
Oh, that's another question. There's a great science fiction writer was involved in that with his banyan trees. I don't know about the vegetation there. We're dealing with primarily Mars Global Surveyor images that are in the 5 to 6 meter per pixel. You know, let's face it, every dot on the screen you see represents a small room in your house. You know, so what are we going to see for vegetation? It could be vegetation. There's considerable discussion about that these days. But that's another argument I try to skirt because we have enough problems arguing artificiality, let alone talk about fluid on the surface, which is supposed to sublime. There's not supposed to be any fluid there. And vegetation, my goodness, the Viking probes came back with positive tests for microbial life there, and it's been controversial for years. Now we're talking vegetation. I don't know if I want to go there.
Wasn't it Arthur C. Clarke that talked about Mars having plant life?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about before. He saw some pictures that look like what he called banyan trees.
Yeah, they do look like vegetation.
Yeah, we have a researcher by the name of Greg Orme from Australia who came up with what he called a spider ravine model to try to explain that. It's very difficult to say. We need to, more science needs to be done. Hey, do you mind if I digress a little bit, go off into another subject?
What's the subject?
Luke Gossett Jr.
Oh, boy, yeah, throwing a quick one.
Put us in a bad spot following that man.
He's a great guy.
What a wonderful erasism. Isn't that a great name?
Actually, he said that he was your warm-up act.
Well, my goodness, yeah, he warmed
us up. Did he know what was
right.
coming after his show?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if he's still in the studio, but...
No, he's gone.
The reason I say this, I feel compelled to say that as an instructor at a local college here, I have the pleasure of getting to know, at least in some capacity, dozens of young people every semester in their early 20s. And you know how people are always saying, this young generation, what's the matter with them? This country's going to crap, No, I feel exactly opposite. all the students I deal with there in their 20s are way better than our crew was when I was their age. They give me hope. And when he talks about tolerance and, you know, racism and stuff, I've discovered that it's almost a non-issue for a lot of young people now. At least in our, we have a surprisingly diverse group for where I live in this part of the country. And it's like they, it's not like they're tolerant. It's like they don't even seem to care. And in a way, it gives a lot. My message to Mr. Goss is that his efforts for people like him are paying off. Our young people are fantastic, and he has. You said that in the segment that, you know, that he's hopeful about humanity, and these
and he really is too.
These young people that I deal with every day, they really do inspire you and give you hope. You know, this is the world is better, is going to be better because of them. And I just wanted to say that because I think Lou Gossett Jr. is going, that is one of the great Americans.
Yeah, I do too. What do some of these young people say about their professor who's writing about geoglyphs on Mars?
You got right back to our subject, didn't you? Yes.
How do you like that?
Tell them about your presentation you did at the college.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do several things at the college. I must say, you know, they don't tend to have the students that I know. I have as many as 8,200 students per semester, and they tend to be have interest. And some of them are just a passing interest. Some of them are ready to argue and argue against you, and I welcome that. They know how to do that. Since the advent of the internet, my goodness, don't the arguments get vitriolic sometimes? It seems there seems to be these two extreme camps. Either you have the extreme skeptic or you have the extreme believer, and George and I are among a group that tries to tread somewhere in the middle. The students in general that I deal with are approach it critically and aren't really ready to make these leaping conclusions without knowing a little something about the situation, have an informed opinion. And it's an interest, I think in part because of these popular TV shows that you see out there.
Uh-huh.
It's an interest, and I don't get those scoffing, exasperated reactions I will sometimes get from people. They're receptive and curious and reserve judgment.
What are the possibilities of these structures, whatever they may be, that they might be cloud-like patterns that, as we, you know, talked about the carpeting and patterns last time, you look up in the sky and see these clouds and you can say, hey, look, there's a dog. There's my grandmother's face.
That comes up all the time. You know, it's just using too much of imagination. It's like looking at clouds is a response I get all the time. And you tend to get that from uninformed people who, I hate to say it, they're uninitiated to the work we're doing. You know, you just don't. I've learned that you do not just take a slide or a picture and plop it in front of somebody and say, "Look, there's a face."
That's right. You got to back it up,
yeah,
and you do.
And of course, if you present it to them like that, it is like looking at clouds. It is like sticking a Rohr chart, in block chart, in front of them. You know, I'm asking them to go ahead and use their imagination. And so, you know, it's hard to present that to people who really don't understand that this is a real satellite image of a real planet, and those are real surface features you're looking at. And yes, you know, you can be fooled, and we're pattern-seeking creatures. You know, we joke last time all about the tortilla chip. You know, you're going to see, but the issue here is this thing good enough to suspect that it had to have been made? And when you look at clouds, you know you're looking at clouds. You're not going to say that was artificial. Maybe a jet contrail, I guess, is artificially made. But see, there's a perfect example. You look at the clouds, you'll see a jet contrail over here and a, you know, cumulus cloud over there. You can just you can differentiate between the artificial and the natural. That's what we're doing.
Well, look at what we're looking at. Cairo means Mars. the Nefertiti figure looks like something that the Egyptians would have. There are a lot of similarities here. And I don't believe in coincidences, as people know by now. It's too weird.
Yeah, you can have coincidences. It could happen. But what are the odds? I like playing cards with people. You know, I'll tell you, the problem is generally that your opinion on whether it could be artificial usually goes right back to your preconceived notions, your predispositions of what can and can't be found on that planet. And there, you know, the problem is that we as researchers who try to present evidence and argue that this is probably artificial, we don't have a real standard of evidence to meet. Dan Drayson, one of our SPSR researchers, wrote a whole big thing about this. He calls it the ever-receding evidential horizon. It's like no matter how much evidence you produce, it's never enough. There's all, and statistical evidence is usually lost on people. You know, you have to kind of sit and play cards a little bit and say, okay, what's the odds the first card on the deck is this particular card? And, you know, and 1 in 52. So if I pick that card off the top of the deck and it's the card and we're betting, you owe me $52. You know, and now we put the card back in and we do it again. What are the odds now? Well, it's 1 in 52 squared, man. You know, they don't really understand the incredible probability, the odds against artificiality. Against it being a natural formation. And so, you know, statistical numbers and things really are lost, don't mean anything to people. And that's basically all we have for an argument is that, you know, when I look at this, I see something that is probably artificial. And it's a very difficult argument to make. I'll tell you the stuff about artificial. I mentioned Sarah Parcak. That's the arguments they have to make when they go to get funding for digs, to get grant money. And somebody at some point has to be convinced that this is worth investigating.
That's right.
And you know, it's a tough argument to make when you're talking about a whole other planet that is outside what Parcak calls the archaeological landscape. You know, it's really weird. It's a strange thing, difficult for people to understand and accept, and it really threatens a lot of worldviews. Some people, I think, sometimes we're accused of psychologically needing to see something in the images. I would argue it's the other way. I think the skeptic has more of a psychological issue there than someone, because they have so much at stake if it turns out to be true.
All right, let's get George's take on this, too. George, go ahead.
It's like what JP's saying. People on the other side, they get very threatened. And, you know, if you convince them that it does look like a face or it does look like it might have been made, you know, then they add more hurdles that you have to jump. Then, you know, who made it, why they make it, and why is it there? And it's all these other questions that you can't answer. So because you can't answer those questions, it must not be real. But the thing that... we have to, like JP was saying, and this is a discussion we have with the other members of the Society for Planetary Study Research, we're trying to establish what a standard would be to say that you're looking at a candidate of a formation on the planet that you want to establish if this meets the criteria to be artificial. And, of course, in clouds and things, you can see a head shape, you know, with a forehead and maybe an eye like we had
right
before.
But, you know, what's funny, someone else might not. I think with these Mars images, everybody can see them.
Exactly. But what I'm just speaking generally, where you could find, you know, rocks around your neighborhood that are tree trunks that kind of look like a face. You know, people say, well, that's what we're seeing on Mars. But those things are very general. They're usually generic. And they don't meet the high standards that we're looking at with this profile face, where we're seeing, you know, secondary features, you know, not only lips, you know, we're seeing the parted lips, the nose as a nostril, and the, all the detail in the eye. It just goes way beyond, you know, just a generalization of a portrait. You know, this is real artwork that we're seeing here in this image.
And what do you think, again, George, on your take, what do you think the reason for this was? I mean, again, you can only see it from above, so they were showing it to somebody.
Yeah, they want somebody that's, you know, that is a spacefaring culture that's flying over this planet to see this and, hey, looky here, look at these things. You know, that was what Richard Hoagland's original idea and premise was about the face on Mars. You know, that was placed there so we would see it, and then we would investigate the Sidonia area and find out all about the 19.5 and the tetrahedral geometry. That's maybe why these things are placed there, for us to catch our eye and come down there and find out what's going on. You know, William Saunders and I, we've got two books full of examples of these things. And, you know, we put the science paper together a couple years ago with the Parrot Formation, which is listed in some of the images that you have up. Just as an example of, you know, the history. We're working on these images, putting a lot of effort in this, getting science papers published. And the reason I think these things are put on the planet is to communicate with us. I think this shows a lot of information about who we are.
How close
That's
do you have
a lot
to
of
be?
These things look familiar.
You can't see it from our planet, though.
No, you'd have to go there.
No, this is a satellite image of a feature that's about, you know, 2-3 clicks, kilometers across, with not a lot of contrast. And, of course, you can't see features like that with telescopes on Earth.
No, not at
just
all.
Just think how if you're an airplane on Earth and there's a large-scale art form, you know, like Nazca maybe, that's a couple of kilometers across, how high up you have to be to appreciate that down there. You know, that's kind of what we're talking about.
The Nazca lines weren't even discovered until the early 1900s when people were flying
over
the area.
That's right.
And back in 2001, down in Caral, Peru, this huge pictograph of a face was found down there while they were excavating this the ruins in the old city of Caral, Peru. And as they were flying in, the archaeologists and the supplies, they looked down, and my God, there's a huge geoglyph that they didn't even know about. And that was just found in, you know, back in 2001. So these things are in, like, the elk over in Russia. These things are being found all the time. And you don't see them on the ground. You're walking right over them. But if you're flying in a spaceship or in an airplane at the right altitude and you look down, then these things all come into focus.
Well, something happened a long, long time ago. And do you think that is the only planet in the solar system that might have these? Think about that. We'll come back, take calls next.